Sometimes I think you enjoy knowing that behind the sacred and the solemn and the serious, there are light moments and odd things happening sort of behind stage. The choir, and I didn't know they were noticing, some of the choir became aware that I sat in the chair a moment ago and built a small boat. I didn't do this because I was bored. I didn't have a pencil. I needed urgently to remember something later. And I have a technique by which I do something odd. You know, I hang the glasses over the bedpost or something, so that when I see that oddity, I see, now there was something I was supposed to remember. And this boat was through that for me, but some of the choir was amused, and one member of the choir, Kathy, on this end, wrote a little note and held it up that said, "Mine." So, I don't know whether it's for her or her two children, but it's hers. I begin this morning with a second minor confession. I'm one of those strange men who actually enjoys mowing the lawn. I think it's because I've spent my life teaching and preaching and have seldom been able to see immediate results. So it's... So it's therapeutic to watch the rows of cut grass line up, all uniform and neat, and then sit back at the end and look out over a finished job. I can hardly imagine paying someone else to do a job that fulfilling, but one summer while I was teaching at the University of Oklahoma and finishing a book-length study on a Shakespeare play, I had to give that particular pleasure up for a few weeks and hire a little boy in the neighborhood to cut my lawn. Well, one night after his third week, I got a phone call from a kid who said, "Mr. Myers, would you like to have somebody mow your lawn?" I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I have a boy doing that for me at present." And I thought that would end our conversation, but after a brief pause, the kid said, "Are you satisfied with his work?" I said, "Yes, I think he's doing fine." He said, "Does he pick up the grass clippings?" I said, "Yes, he does, and he even hauls them off for me." "Does he sweep off your sidewalk?" Well, I was ready to get on to other things, so I said, "Yes, he does that too. And I must say, you really are persistent. I guess I should admire that. Who are you anyway?" He said, "Well, I'm the little boy that already cuts your grass. I just wanted to see how I was doing." Now, I'm sure this kid had never heard the famous comment of Socrates that the unexamined life is not worth living. But he had figured out a way to test himself, and my guess is that he went on to make something good of his life. We have professors and students in this room who know all about midterm and final exams to measure how we've done in class. But what about measuring how well we do in developing character? Is there some objective test, some visible fruit produced in our lives so that we and others can tell if we are making any progress in what the Apostle Paul calls the life of the Spirit? Paul writes his Galatian church about something all of us know, given any degree of introspection at all, that we have a higher nature and a lower nature, and that we always live in some degree of tension between the two. Paul lists some of the traits of our lower nature: hatred, quarreling, jealousy, envy, strife. And then he lists what he calls the fruits of the Spirit, the harvest of a life controlled by the approach Jesus took to living. The people to whom he wrote lived off the land, so talking about character traits as if they were like fruit from a vine or a tree made good sense. One of my fondest memories as a boy is of a couple of peach trees and a cherry tree in our backyard. I spent hours up in the branches of those trees in the summer. The peaches seemed sweeter and the cherries bigger and redder than any I have ever seen or tasted since. But all of you past 40 know what that means. They were probably quite ordinary, but I was young and they were the first fruits I had ever picked all by myself, half hidden up among the leaves. They taught me how to judge a tree, not by the trunk or the leaves, however healthy they looked, but by their fruit. If they produced nothing, my omniscient father dismissed them as failures, and I can remember watching eagerly to see if the lovely spring blossoms of promise actually turned into fruit buds and began to swell. Character is invisible, except in action. We can't see somebody's spirit, but we can see the fruit it produces, and we can judge character in ourselves and others by the harvest that is visible. Not that we won't have a bad day. Not every peach on the tree is perfect. We judge by the tenor of a life, not by a moment of weakness. But if we wonder whether we are growing in grace and goodness, whether our faith and worship life makes any difference, there is a way of testing. Paul names 9 different kinds of fruit on the tree of Christian character, and I propose in several sermons to describe them so that you and I can see how well we do. You can tell the minute you read or hear them that 9 is an absolutely arbitrary number. Paul could have added some others, but 9 is no accident. 3 was a sacred number in Jewish literature, and 3 times 3 would strike his readers as a full, perfect number. And so he used it. If you cultivate the Spirit of Christ in your life, he says, you reap a harvest of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, fidelity, humility, and self-control. I'm not surprised that Paul begins with love. It was he, after all, who wrote the famous 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, in which he calls love the greatest thing in the world. I did 24 sermons on that chapter a year ago, and you must wonder how I could possibly find anything else to say about love. But the truth is that we have to be reminded constantly what Christian love, called agape in the New Testament, really is, and how it's different from our usual definitions of love. So forgive me for saying this again, but we always have people present who have not heard it, and it's impossible to talk sensibly about Christian love without defining it. We know that emotions cannot be commanded. They arise involuntarily. So agape love is not founded in emotion. We are told to love everybody, but not everybody is easy even to like. In fact, we've all known a few people we found it impossible to like. So if agape love means liking, we're in terrible difficulty trying to fulfill the commandment. The only possible way to do it is to realize that agape love is not an emotional response to people, but an act of will, a steady, firm resolve to treat people right, not because we like them, but because we are under orders to treat them as if we did. Now, this isn't easy, and we flunk the test often. A minister I know in Fort Worth tells about a man and his daughter who got on a hotel elevator and headed up. And about three floors up, the elevator stopped, and an absolutely gorgeous woman walked on, pushed the button for her floor, and up the three of them went. But suddenly, the woman turned around and slapped the father across the face with all her might. At that moment, the elevator reached her floor and she got off. The little girl turned to her dad and said, "She didn't like you, did she?" Puzzled and still rubbing his red cheek, he said, "I guess not." "Well, don't feel bad," the little girl told him. "I didn't like her. She stepped on my toe and I pinched her." Well, two people on that elevator acted on sudden emotional impulse. One got stepped on, one got pinched, and the only one who didn't react was the one who had the best reason of all. His face stung. He had to feel a deep sense of injustice, but he had a little better control of his emotions. We understand agape love when we understand that by an act of the trained and conscious will, it can respond in ways quite opposite to what our feelings may be. We can desire the right and fair thing for a stranger. We can even do the right thing by somebody who is actively disagreeable if our will is trained. Another way to put it is to say that agape love begins with how we see people, not with how we look at them, which is one thing, but how we see them. I had an odd experience a year or so ago when I was reading a book one afternoon in the magnificent library reading room on the University of Oklahoma campus. It's a majestic, high-ceilinged temple of dark oak and deep leather chairs with the hushed quiet of a medieval cathedral. I know that some of you think that nothing ever happens on the OU campus except football and Billy Tubbs, but this great reading room is one of the loveliest places in the country. And while I waited there that day on my son to come from teaching in a building where I had taught before he was born, I sat reading this paragraph from the most poetic preacher in America, Frederick Buechner. Listen to it. "We can see each other's faces, and every once in a while, if we have our eyes open, we can see something of what is within those faces. Even with strangers, sometimes, people we pass on the street or find sitting across from us in a bus or a waiting room, even sometimes with people we know very well, but seldom take the trouble really to look at. We see something, and I hope every husband and every wife in this room knows exactly what this means. We see something that stops us in our tracks. We catch a glimpse of some unexpected beauty or pain or need in another's face. Or maybe we just notice the tilt of an old man's cap, or the way a young woman rests her cheek on the palm of her hand, or the way a child looks out the window at the rain. And for a moment then, our heart goes out to them in ways too deep for words. Well, I remember that I put the book down and looked around at the handful of boys and girls bent over their books in that huge, quiet place, intense, learning, shut away from cars and laughter and football games, and I felt love for them. Not liking, because I didn't know them, but agape love that not only wished them good luck as if they were my very own, but would have responded instantly and gladly if I could have helped them in some way. Now, I know why this happened. I was waiting for someone. I couldn't rush the clock. I wasn't too busy to see past my own schedule. And I had been reading about agape love. Most of the time, I'm hell-bent on some form of self-service or institutional service, busy with necessary stuff, even good stuff, but busy. I don't know who wrote this humorous prayer, but I found some glimpses of my own things-centered life in it, and some of you may as well. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray my Cuisinart to keep. I pray my stocks are on the rise and that my analyst is wise, that all the wine I sip is white and that my hot tub's watertight, that racquetball won't get too tough, that all my sushi, I have a hard time with that word, that all my sushi's fresh enough. I pray my cordless phone still works, that my career won't lose its perks, my microwave won't radiate, my condo won't depreciate, I pray my health club doesn't close, and that my money market grows. If I go broke before I wake, I pray my Lexus they won't take. Now, I would not try to deceive you. Every request in that prayer is perfectly sensible. But I just want to be sure I know, and you know, that it has nothing to do with agape love, which is the opposite of such a tight little circle of concern. Examples work for us better than anything, so here is one from a Kansas City minister who was trying one Sunday morning to define agape love for his congregation, trying to say it in a way that would be memorable for them, pointing out, for example, that it is not a moment's lust, not even a romantic evening of violins and roses, but the glad sacrifice of time and effort when there is not much to gain except perhaps the momentary comfort of another person. He told about Frank and Mary Sager, an Ohio couple who had known the lust and had their children, who had known the romantic evenings and treasured them all in memory, who had come near the end of days with one kind of love more durable than all the other kinds. Hospitalized, Frank was doing poorly. His wife, Mary, came into the room again and drew her chair close to the bed. "I'm thirsty," he whispered. She lifted the straw to his lips while he pulled the oxygen mask aside. The medicine was making him sick, so she fetched the basin, wrapped a firm arm around his shoulders, frailer than she had ever known them to be, and mopped the sweat from his forehead. Nothing terribly dramatic or unusual. It's happening at this very moment in some hospital or bed room, home bedroom, not far from where we sit. But it may help us to keep things in balance if we remember that in the end, love comes down to this, not some Richard Gere interlude with Julia Roberts or the clink of crystal by candlelight or the leisurely picnic spread out in summer clover. Those are all good in their time. But if they grow into agape love, the ultimate unselfish love, what they come down to at last is a squeeze of the hand. I'm here. I'll be here, no matter how long the struggle. Water? You need water? Here. Drink. Let me straighten your pillow.